We could avoid any interference in Alabama, and said he felt sure the governor could straighten it out. Meanwhile, the harassment of boycott leaders in Montgomery intensified. On February 21st, 115 boycott organizers, among whom were King and 23 other clergymen, were indicted by a grand jury for conducting an illegal boycott. The grand jury held these black leaders responsible for spreading distrust, dislike, and hatred in a community which for more than a generation has enjoyed exemplary race relations. To this, King replied from the rostrum of the First Baptist Church, where black leaders had gathered in protest of the arrest warrants, "This is not a war between the white and the Negro, but a conflict between justice and injustice." On February 25th, the Council of Bishops of the African Methodist Episcopal Church appealed publicly to Eisenhower to use federal authority to intervene in the dispute. By its 12th week, the boycott had become national news. As the Washington Post reported, "The eyes of Alabama, the South, and now the nation are on Montgomery." 7. The administration was struggling to prepare a response to the events in the South. In fact, since December 1955, Attorney General Brownell had been drafting proposals to present to Congress that would empower the Justice Department to investigate and prosecute civil rights violations. Brownell had been frustrated by his inability to do anything in the Till case, and the blatant violations of voting rights in the South now left him determined to strengthen the federal government's hand. But there was also a political calculation here. On February 29, 1956, the president announced that he would run for re-election. At a stroke, the White House began thinking about everything through the lens of politics. In a memo to Adams, Rabb went so far as to call for a new look at our civil rights policy from a partisan viewpoint. He felt it was time to break this iron curtain of silence on our civil rights case and seek out northern black voters. With a more active civil rights program, he suggested, "We can still gain, without too much effort, a 5 to 10% increase in the black vote, which would be decisive in fringe districts." Brownell agreed that there might be some electoral benefits from pushing moderate civil rights legislation, but he worried more about determining just what power the federal government really possessed to protect basic civil rights in the states. Brownell believed he simply did not have enough authority to mount a successful legal challenge to recalcitrant Southerners, and he wanted to strengthen his hand. He therefore drew up 4 proposals that he submitted to the cabinet and the president for consideration. First, he drafted a bill to create a civil rights commission that had subpoena power to investigate ongoing abuses. Second, he wanted a new civil rights division in the Justice Department with additional authority and resources. Third, and more boldly, he wanted to be able to pursue civil injunctions against defiant local and state authorities who were violating the basic civil rights and voting rights of black citizens. Brownell pitched this idea as a gentle way of exercising federal power. Instead of prosecuting local officials for a crime, he could bring civil proceedings against them if they were seen to be interfering with voting rights. And fourth, Brownell wanted broader Justice Department powers to investigate any conspiracy that aimed at the deprivation of civil and voting rights. Taken as a package, these proposals, if they became law, would substantially increase the Justice Department's power to compel desegregation in the South. Brownell faced some serious headwinds in getting his ideas made into law. In a March 9, 1956 cabinet meeting in which Brownell was scheduled to present his proposals for discussion, Hoover beat him to the punch. The FBI director had been invited to give an update on the racial tensions in the South since Brown, and he did not miss his chance. His report to the cabinet was chilling. Once again using the old canard that the NAACP was being infiltrated by the Communist Party, Hoover depicted black activist organizations as provocative and dangerous. Their spokesman, he said, had declared that white blood will flow, and he singled out the bus boycott in Montgomery as an example of the NAACP's revolutionary activities. Hoover praised white Southerners who had reacted to provocations by forming citizens' councils made up of bankers, lawyers, doctors, state legislators, and industrialists. That is, some of the leading citizens of the South. These men were protecting historic traditions and customs and would not abandon them without a struggle. The situation was a powder keg, Hoover darkly declared, and some overzealous but ill-advised leaders of the NAACP and the Communist Party were likely to set off an explosion. With this remarkable presentation having cast a pall over the cabinet room, Brownell introduced his plans for new civil rights legislation. He ran into criticism from Agriculture Secretary Ezra Benson, HEW Secretary Marion Folsom, a Georgian, and others who questioned the need to move quickly on the package of civil rights proposals. Eisenhower backed Brownell, but also launched into an impassioned plea for tolerance and respect for the deep emotions surrounding this subject. He urged Brownell to moderate the tone of the proposed legislation. "Don't take the attitude that you are another Charles Sumner," Ike said, referring to the radical Republican senator from Massachusetts who had violently denounced slavery during the 1850s and led the fight to grant civil rights to African Americans after the Civil War. The president insisted, "These people in the South were not breaking the law for the past 60 years. Now we cannot erase the emotions of three generations just overnight. People have a right to disagree with the Supreme Court decision, since the Supreme Court has disagreed with its own decision of 60 years standing. But of course the new decision should now be carried out." Eisenhower asked Brownell to resubmit revised and toned-down proposals to the cabinet. Just 2 days later, and perfectly timed to complicate Brownell's efforts, a leading Virginia congressman, Howard Smith, and Georgia Senator Walter F. George read on the floor of their respective chambers a Declaration of Constitutional Principles, which rapidly earned the sobriquet the Southern Manifesto. It denounced the Supreme Court's decision in Brown as an abuse of power, described the court as having destroyed in a stroke the amicable relations between the white and Negro races that have been created through 90 years of patient effort by the good people of both races, denounced outside agitators who wanted to bring revolutionary changes, and pledged to halt the implementation of school desegregation. The document was signed by 82 representatives and 19 senators, about one-fifth of the Congress, all Democrats, except for two Virginia Republicans. Every one of the signatories, including the 1952 Democratic vice presidential candidate John Sparkman of Alabama, hailed from the Confederacy. The South now spoke with one voice. It would not recognize federal law. A constitutional crisis loomed. No wonder, then, that Eisenhower's advisers were becoming exasperated. However, their anger was not directed at Southern white leaders, but at black activists. Fred Morrow, despondent, wrote a long and revealing entry in his diary about the atmosphere in the administration. Even Max Rabb, normally a close ally, gave Morrow a tongue-lashing about black behavior. After all Eisenhower had done, Rabb asserted, Negroes had not demonstrated any kind of gratitude, and most of the responsible officials in the White House had become completely disgusted with the whole matter. He said there was a feeling that Negroes were being too aggressive in their demands, that an ugliness and surliness in manner was beginning to show through. What black leaders wanted, Rabb told Morrow, far exceeded what reasonable white people would grant. And Rabb was Ike's chief advisor on minority affairs. When the cabinet convened on March 23rd to reconcile Brownell's civil rights proposals, the attorney general ran into still more opposition. John Foster Dulles, just back from a trip to Asia, thought the laws Brownell proposed deviated too far from accepted mores and should be shelved. Defense Secretary Wilson and HEW Secretary Folsom also pounced on the proposal, saying things were too dangerous already, without adding more fuel to the fire. The leading members of the cabinet had thus arranged themselves against Brownell's civil rights proposals. The president himself now began to worry about piling up laws that could not be enforced. On March 20th, he spoke with Reverend Billy Graham, who told him that desegregation would come eventually, but that the South has a fixed tradition and could not be forced to move quickly. A consensus was forming. New federal laws to strengthen civil rights protections would only intensify the fury of Southern whites. The discussion was brought to a close when Eisenhower asked Brownell to see him after the cabinet meeting had adjourned. In that closed session, Eisenhower broke the news to Brownell. He could not support the controversial third provision of the bill that strengthened the Attorney General's hand in fighting civil rights violations. It was just too provocative in an election season. No verbatim record of that meeting exists, but Eisenhower must have sensed Brownell's deep disappointment because he offered some compensation. Brownell could submit parts 1 and 2 to Congress as formal legislative proposals, while merely suggesting that the ideas present in parts 3 and 4 be considered. Brownell would have to present that case to Congress. If there was going to be a fight, he would take the heat. Eisenhower had decided to stay out of it. Brownell accepted the challenge and began navigating the tricky waters of Congress with great cleverness. Knowing Eisenhower's objections, he softened the proposals that he sent to the House Judiciary Committee. But he also tipped off his New York friend, Congressman Kenneth Keating, who ensured that the proposal to strengthen the Justice Department's ability to prosecute civil rights violations was beefed up in the bill's language. It was a clever piece of chicanery, and it allowed Brownell to report to Eisenhower that he had followed the president's instructions while also posing as a stalwart advocate for bolder civil rights powers for the Justice Department. Crucially, this bit of theater also gave Eisenhower himself some distance from the legislation. It was Brownell's bill as far as the administration was concerned, and he fought for it with verve. In hearings in Congress in April, as well as in public addresses in New York and Washington, Brownell urged Congress to act to protect the right of every American to vote, and in particular, to protect black citizens from what he called haters and opportunists. New York Times reporter Anthony Lewis described his words as the strongest spoken thus far on the racial issue by any member of the administration. It was an impressive performance, and by early summer, a new four-part civil rights bill was working its way through the House of Representatives. On July 23rd, it passed the House by 276 to 126 votes, drawing bipartisan support from Republicans and Northern liberal Democrats. The first civil rights legislation since Reconstruction now moved on to the Senate. And there it died, as everyone knew it would. Southern Democrats dominated the Senate committees through which the bill had to pass. Instead of considering the bill, the Senate went on summer recess and would not take it up again until 1957. Eisenhower did not seem to mind. He did not endorse the legislation in public, though privately he assured Republican congressmen he still favored it. Indeed, despite his success in pushing moderate civil rights reforms in his first term, Eisenhower tried his best to stay clear of the subject during the fall election season for fear of alienating whites in the South who might be tempted to vote Republican. For Eisenhower, it was time to let the civil rights issue cool off a bit. But it was not for the president to adjust the temperature of the racial conflict that was gaining intensity across the South. Provocations and violence kept the crisis on a high boil. In late August 1956, exactly a year after Emmett Till's horrific murder, a voice Eisenhower would come to hear frequently rose up from the front lines of the racial struggle and called for the president to turn his attention to Montgomery, a city marred by racial violence, the bombing of the homes of religious leaders, mass arrests, and intimidation of black citizens. Hundreds of Negroes are being arrested daily on trumped-up charges and fined. The revival of the Ku Klux Klan is a constant threat, and the robed members are allowed to demonstrate in the city without police interference whatsoever. Thousands of Negroes in the city of Montgomery in the state of Alabama are deprived of their right to vote. Surely now was the time for the president to use The power of your office to see that the proper investigation is made in Montgomery and Alabama, to the end that justice and law will prevail. The voice was that of Martin Luther King, Jr., still leading the 9-month-old bus boycott in Montgomery, still clinging to the hope that Washington would respond to the outcry of black citizens across the South who clamored for justice. Eisenhower remained impassive. He would not be drawn into King's movement. Although Ike managed the civil rights problems of 1953 through 56 with dexterity, compiling a record of progress as good as that of any of his 20th century predecessors, he refused to lead the country to embrace a new era of civil rights. As resistance to Brown increased, and as the battle lines formed for a prolonged period of conflict, Eisenhower retreated from the battlefield, seeking the comfort of the distant hills, while Brownell continued to fight in the trenches below. If this was an example of Ike's hidden hand, it was a disappointing performance for those who yearned for some sign from America's most powerful and popular leader that their struggle was also his. Chapter 10. God, Government, and the Middle Way. The Republican Party must be known as a progressive organization, or it is sunk. 1. Just after Christmas 1955, Eisenhower received some welcome news from George Gallup, the pollster and director of the American Institute of Public Opinion. Americans, Gallup reported, considered Eisenhower the most admired man in the world, at the head of a distinguished pack that included Winston Churchill, Douglas MacArthur, Harry Truman, Albert Schweitzer, Pope Pius XII, and the Reverend Billy Graham. Yet the president was probably not surprised by the honor. He had also topped the list in 1954, and in 1953, 1952, and 1951. Indeed, Ike would be America's most admired man for 10 straight years, between 1951 and 1960. Americans also approved overwhelmingly of his performance in office. During his 8 years as president, he enjoyed an average approval rating of 65%. He was especially popular in his first term, winning approval from 70% of the American public in those 4 years. The lowest score Eisenhower tallied was in the midst of a recession in the spring of 1958, when his approval rating dropped briefly to 48%. Still higher than the average rating for Truman's entire presidency. In short, Americans loved Ike. Why? Peace and prosperity helped, though even when crises in Korea, China, Taiwan, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East erupted, Ike remained popular. Nor did significant slowdowns of the economy in 1953 to 54 and 1957 to 58 substantially mar his reputation. It would be easy to chalk up Eisenhower's popularity simply to his personality, his charm, his affability, and above all, the lingering effect of his wartime laurels. Yet there is more to the story than that, for the key to Eisenhower's success lay in his ability to balance, in his own person and in his policies, the contradictions in American society. People liked him because he seemed to embody so many virtues that they admired, even when these virtues were in tension with one another. As an acute observer of the era, William Lee Miller noted in a 1958 essay, Ike was ordinary and extraordinary at the same time. He combined the personal grandeur of success in battle with the familiar friendliness of the man next door. He found a way to reconcile the cross-cutting tendencies of the American character, the practical, competitive, individualistic, externally minded, environment-mastering and success-seeking on the one hand, and the spiritual, idealistic, friendly, team-working, moralizing, and reform-seeking on the other. Mr. Eisenhower exactly summarized both. Actions that might have seemed hypocritical and even schizophrenic in a lesser man appeared when performed by Eisenhower, to be evidence of a tempered and moderate philosophy that transcended mere politics. He could trumpet the virtues of capitalism and individual success, even as he called for Americans to go to church more often and abjure materialism. He insisted on conservative government, demanded tight budgets, and inveighed against the dangers of statism, yet he also hailed the beneficial role of government in providing public schools, roads and bridges, airports and public housing, hospitals and old age pensions to American citizens. The last president born in the 19th century welcomed innovation, modernity, new technologies, the space age, and global travel and communication. Liberal intellectuals like Adlai Stevenson and Arthur Schlesinger Jr., as well as right-wing pundits such as William F. Buckley, found Ike's political shape-shifting infuriating. But the voters admired his uncanny ability to float above the partisan scrum. No wonder, then, that Americans loved Ike. He was big enough to embody their collective hopes and dreams. He was a Texan, a Kansan, a Coloradan, and a New Yorker, a soldier and a peacemaker, a poor country boy and a wealthy elitist, a devoted reader of scripture who seldom went to church until he was 62, a beer and hot dog man who fettered his powerful White House guests with pheasant under glass. With his example in mind, Americans could aspire to riches, power, and personal success without losing their moral compass. They could earnestly talk up the importance of bootstraps and personal responsibility while demanding that their government care for them. They could embrace change and modernity while also venerating their elders and attending church in record-breaking numbers. Here lie the elements of the Eisenhower phenomenon. By personifying and reconciling these contradictions, he made Americans believe that they, like him, could have it all. 2. On Sunday, February 7, 1954, the President and Mrs. Eisenhower went to worship at the National Presbyterian Church in Washington. Immediately after the service, the President appeared on a CBS television and radio broadcast to kick off the American Legion's Back to God campaign. Started in 1951 as a way to honor the famous four chaplains, ministers of four different denominations who died at sea during the war when they gave their life jackets to others on board their sinking ship. The Back to God campaign had become a signature annual event in which leading churchmen and rabbis gathered in ecumenical fellowship, called upon their listeners to rededicate themselves to a life of godliness and spirituality. Eisenhower's remarks in the broadcast aimed to link the American experience to religious zeal. Out of faith in God, and through faith in themselves as his children, our forefathers designed and built the Republic, the president said. He gave a brief civics lesson that recalled the struggles of the Pilgrims, the testing of George Washington at Valley Forge, and the determined battle of Abraham Lincoln to save the Union. All of them shared a steadfast belief in God. The one unifying feature of the American experience, Eisenhower insisted, was faith. By the millions we speak prayers, we sing hymns, and no matter what their words may be, their spirit is the same. In God is our trust. In 1954, as America again faced a time of crisis and struggle, there is a need for positive acts of renewed recognition that faith is our surest strength. This speech briefly captured perfectly Eisenhower's instrumental view of religion. The doctrinal content of religious devotion need not divide Americans so long as they shared a basic commitment to faith and belief. The differences between sects paled in contrast to the yawning gap between believers and non-believers. And of course, the seedbed of such non-belief was atheistic communism. To believe in God was itself an act of resistance, and defiance of communism, however one worshipped God, did not matter, so long as one was willing to acknowledge the power of a higher being. The president was joined in this televised appeal by two of the leading public religious figures of the day, the Reverend Fulton J. Sheen, a bishop of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of New York, and Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, pastor of the Marble Collegiate Church in New York City. Bishop Sheen was well known as the longtime host of the radio show The Catholic Hour, and since 1951, the impresario of the television program Life is Worth Living. Among the first clergymen to use the new medium of television to reach his flock, Sheen, with his gaunt face and deep-set eyes, could be seen weekly at 8 p.m. across the nation. Robed in a full-length cassock, bearing a pectoral cross on a chain around his neck, topped by a small skullcap, Sheen delivered commentary on topics ranging from marriage and alcoholism to freedom, the devil, love, and purgatory. He stood before a chalkboard, occasionally turning away from the camera to jot down a few key words like a skilled 10th grade English teacher. He usually started by recounting a humdrum tale of ordinary life, perhaps sent to him in a letter from a viewer. He would mind this for its didactic value and throw in a few light witticisms along the way. Quiet, composed, articulate, Sheen's TV personality entranced millions of Americans, drawing audiences as large as those that tuned into Milton Berle and Bob Hope. Peel, a pudgy, bespectacled Methodist with a flair for homespun stories and down-to-earth verities, had become a national phenomenon as the author of wildly popular Christian self-help books. The idea for such guidebooks was not Peel's alone. In 1939, Alcoholics Anonymous appeared on America's bookshelves, offering a 12-step method for treating not just alcoholism, but other social diseases. The crucial step in these programs was the recognition of a higher power that could provide spiritual sustenance as one progressed through the prescribed treatment. Peel saw a church-building opportunity in the yearning of Americans to overcome their personal problems and achieve success. He offered a simple therapy for any affliction: belief in God. In a stream of publications as well as radio and television appearances, he provided audiences simple steps to improve their lives and grasp the financial, personal, social, and professional success they desired. Books like Inspired Messages for Daily Living compiled passages from the Bible that could serve as health-producing, life-changing, power-creating thought conditioners for people experiencing anxiety, insomnia, fatigue, lack of confidence, frustration, and more. These troubles were easily treatable by reciting scripture. If you wanted to know, for example, how to break the worry habit, or how to make your work easy, or how to get people to like you, Peel offered easy techniques, all of which amounted to reciting a few passages of the Bible, selected by Peel himself. Such spiritual exercises, Peel claimed, amounted to a magic formula for personal happiness and success. He found an enormous audience for his Christian home remedies. His book, The Power of Positive Thinking, appeared in 1952 and stayed on the bestseller list for 186 weeks. He became a much-admired public figure and would go on to develop a close personal friendship with Richard Nixon. If Peel and Sheen were friendly Christian showmen, Ike's own pastor, Reverend Edward Elson, offered sterner counsel. In 1954, Elson published a small book, America's Spiritual Recovery, dedicated to the president. The introduction was written by another parishioner, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Elson declared that America found itself in a period of real moral sag and deterioration. He drew a desperate portrait of the nation's ills: soaring crime, kowtowing admiration for the tycoons of business and the captains of industry, the veneration of money and profit, and the lapse of religious worship. Children, he said, no longer respected their parents. Jazz, modern art, and vulgar films like Death of a Salesman and A Streetcar Named Desire that glorified a deteriorating personality offered more evidence of a collapse of morals. Schools no longer taught Christian precepts. The militant atheism of communism threatened the world. Yet Ellison also found reason for optimism. Amid these grave moral threats, the greatest religious awakening in the history of our nation was underway. American worshippers were filling the churches and making plans to build many more. 6 out of every 10 Americans formerly belonged to a church, the highest ratio in the country's history, he wrote. Every week, 85 million Americans bowed their heads in prayer in the house of worship. Students on college campuses had shown renewed enthusiasm for religious instruction. The recent best-selling books in the nation included the Bible, books by Reverend Peel and Bishop Sheen, and other inspirational texts and tales. Elson did not mention that this was also the period in which Hollywood produced blockbuster movies on religious themes, such as Quo Vadis, 1951, The Ten Commandments, 1956, and Ben-Hur, 1959. Elson believed that Eisenhower's election to the presidency had triggered this religious revival. Ike had become the focal point of a moral resurgence and spiritual awakening of national proportions. His inaugural prayer, given on the steps of the Capitol, had signaled the return of faith into public life, as did his decision to start his cabinet meetings with prayer. It is not an exaggeration to say that the business which receives the attention of the president is surrounded with an atmosphere of prayer. Ike's moral and spiritual leadership could save America from what Elson saw as a grave threat. Not only the nation's internal moral collapse, but the gathering forces of atheism and communism. Marxism presented such a great danger because it offered a new world religion and aimed to unseat Christianity. The philosophies of the sickle and the cross, Elson said, are irreconcilable, and only one of them could survive. If Christianity was to triumph, communism must be vanquished. This kind of public piety, moralism, and prophetic speech saturated the age of Eisenhower, and it squared perfectly with the language of the new administration. It is not surprising, then, that Ike found himself drawn to and befriended by the most significant evangelist of the post-war years, Billy Graham, with whom he shared many basic ideas about the relationship of spiritual faith to the creation of a well-ordered society. Graham, a tall, rangy Baptist, grew up on a dairy farm near Charlotte, North Carolina, went to college in Wheaton, Illinois, and started his preaching in a Chicago-based organization called Youth for Christ in the mid-1940s. His talent, sincerity, zeal, and sheer charisma sped him on his way to stardom. In 1949, his enormous Los Angeles revival meeting, which he called a crusade, attracted nationwide press coverage. In 1951, Texas oil man Sid Richardson urged Graham to add his voice to the chorus then calling for General Eisenhower to run for president. Graham gladly complied, asking Eisenhower to offer himself to the American people. Richardson arranged for Graham to meet the general at Shape headquarters in Paris in March 1952, just after Ike won the New Hampshire primary. Eisenhower welcomed Graham into his modern, newly constructed office and spoke with the pastor of his spiritual life, especially his upbringing among the devout River Brethren in Kansas. Graham reported on the crusade he had recently concluded in Washington, D.C. They sat together for 2 hours and formed a bond. In August, after Eisenhower won the GOP nomination, he invited Graham to Denver to the Brown Palace Hotel, where he asked Graham to help him find appropriate themes and scriptural passages to work into his campaign speeches. Graham's influence hung on some of Eisenhower's campaign statements. When Ike was asked to describe his religious beliefs for the Episcopal Church News in September 1952, he responded, "You can't explain free government in any other terms than religious. The Founding Fathers had to refer to the Creator in order to make their revolutionary experiment make sense. It is ours to prove that only a people strong in godliness is strong enough to overcome tyranny and make themselves and others free." He concluded, "What is our battle against communism if it is not a fight between anti-God and belief in the Almighty? America's problems might be easier to solve," Eisenhower opined, "if every American would dwell more upon the simple virtues, integrity, courage, self-confidence, and an unshakable belief in his Bible, After the election, Graham sent the new president a fairly steady stream of correspondence, updating him on the activities of his ministry. In June 1953, Graham reported that his month-long revival in Dallas drew 25,000 people a night and was the largest evangelistic crusade in the history of the United States. He found the American people hungry for God, and he told Eisenhower that in Dallas, a crowd of 75,000 at the Cotton Bowl rose up as one, bowed their heads, and prayed that God would give you wisdom, courage, and strength. To see so many people praying for their president, Graham wrote, was one of the most beautiful and moving sights I have ever seen. A few months later, Graham sent word that the president's constant references to spiritual needs and faithful attendance at church have done much to help in the spiritual awakening that is taking place throughout the nation. In November 1953, Graham called on Eisenhower in the White House to update the president on his long-planned crusade in Britain and present to him a startling gift, a book signed by several hundred Chinese and North Korean prisoners who, while being held in South Korean camps, were converted to Christianity. These were POWs who had asked not to be repatriated after the Korean armistice. Alongside their names, they stamped their fingerprints, using their own blood as ink. Upon leaving the White House that day, Graham told the president that Eisenhower's religious devotion had inspired the nation. Graham's ministry suited an era of robust individualism, for the evangelist spoke about the need to bring people to Christ as the answer to the world's problems. "We must be born again," he said. "If we change men, we can change the world. We've got to do something about all the hating, cheating, lying, and stealing in the world today." He summed up his approach to the temporal world by saying repeatedly, "Human nature, not the hydrogen bomb, is the world's chief problem. Fix human nature by conversion, and the anxieties of the atomic age would disappear." This emphasis on the freedom of the individual to choose a way of life, to make what Graham called a decision for Christ, squared with Eisenhower's belief that religious values, because they bring people to do the right thing, are crucial to a well-ordered society. "Religious principles," Eisenhower told an audience of interfaith leaders in February 1955, "must not be kept in a realm apart from everyday life. Without God, there could be no American form of government, nor an American way of life. Recognition of the Supreme Being is the first, the most basic expression of Americanism. Human rights," Eisenhower asserted, "are granted by God, not the state. And as such, they are inviolable. The government must protect and defend these rights. It must never abridge them. Between man and his creator, no government should intervene." On March 6, 1955, Graham achieved a milestone. He delivered a sermon directly to an American president. As the guest of Reverend Elson at the National Presbyterian Church, Graham spoke on faith in our times. Again, he stressed the message that the Cold War and the H-bomb, juvenile delinquency, racial strife, moral weakness, all these worries could be cured instantly by conversion to Christ. They all sprang from a single source, sinful human nature. Fix that, and the world would be free of trouble. Not every theologian shared Graham's simple answer to the problems of the age. Reinhold Niebuhr, the leading Christian intellectual of the era and a professor at Union Theological Seminary, published a searing essay in The New Republic in June 1955 that addressed the surge in popular piety. Niebuhr had no time for the likes of Norman Vincent Peale and Bishop Sheen, whom he described as mere entertainers. Graham he treated with more respect and more venom. Niebuhr attacked Graham's perfectionist illusions and his simple religious moralism, which claimed that conversion to Christianity could solve the problem of the hydrogen bomb. Niebuhr accused Graham and Eisenhower of equating faith with good plumbing as the core values of the American way of life. What angered Niebuhr was the smug, complacent, self-regarding contentment of powerful men, both in government and in the churches, who decided that simple religious faith would resolve the social and political crises of the age. Eisenhower dismissed this kind of criticism. He shared Graham's belief that government could at best only ameliorate social problems, not fix them, and that God and gumption formed the true essence of the American experience. In his State of the Union address in January 1954, he said, "Government alone could not make people industrious or enterprising. It was up to them to work hard for their future prosperity." Similarly, he said, "Americans know how to balance God against greed. Though blessed with more material goods than any people in history, Americans have always reserved their first allegiance to the kingdom of the Spirit, which is the true source of that freedom we value above all material things." He told the annual meeting of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in May 1955 that America became great by mixing religious faith with the spirit of free enterprise. Yes, government occasionally had a role to play in softening the blows of modern life, but what made America great was its combination of deep religious faith and individualism. With God, prosperity, and individual freedom at work on America's side, we cannot lose. We simply cannot lose. 3. Thus Eisenhower believed it possible to balance prayer and prosperity, doxology and dollars, godliness and good times. Viewed from a later age, such pairings might appear cynical and hypocritical. But Eisenhower believed in balance, in finding the right calibration between moral purpose and creature comforts. He did not see prosperity as immoral. Rather, he saw it as a reward for hard work and sacrifice. A blessed nation had earned a bountiful harvest. Eisenhower could sustain this belief because, to a surprising degree, many Americans shared in the prosperity of the 1950s. Unlike the boom times of the Gilded Age or the dot-com bubble of the 1990s, the prosperity of the 1950s ran both deep and broad. The bane of American society in the 21st century, drastic economic inequality, did not afflict the nation to the same degree during the Roaring Fifties. Incomes grew at roughly the same pace for all groups, and those at the very top of the economic pyramid paid far more taxes than the wealthy do today. Instead of enriching only a few fat cats, 1950s-era prosperity helped create and nourish what is now a vanishing species, the American middle class. Here lies the source of much later nostalgia for the age of Eisenhower. The 1950s was the decade in which many citizens appeared to have realized that elusive goal, the American dream. Numbers can help tell this story. At the start of the age of Eisenhower, in 1950, Americans were already making 2 to 3 times the hourly wage they had earned in 1935, so they began the decade in an atmosphere of optimism. In 1948 through 53, unemployment was negligible, averaging just 4%. In manufacturing, hourly wages rose from 58 cents an hour in 1935 to $1.59 in 1950. The average American family income was $4,237 in 1950, a dramatic improvement from the depression-racked 1930s. But of course, prices had shot up as well. In 1950, a pound of butter cost twice what it had 15 years earlier, and the price of meat had tripled. Average family expenditures in 1950 ran to $3,800, so while Americans in 1950 had more money in their pockets, they spent most of it on the high cost of living. But if economic trends looked promising in 1950, few could have predicted just how prosperous the coming decade would be. The gross national product nearly doubled in the decade from $285 billion to $500 billion. Average family income in 1960 stood at $6,691, a 51% increase from the then record levels of 1950. Wages rose sharply across the decade in key industries. In manufacturing, mining, construction, transportation, and finance, hourly wages increased well over a dollar an hour, in some cases up 60% in just a decade. These numbers were especially important because, in the 1950s, America was still a nation of factories. In 39% of American households, the head of the family was employed in manufacturing of some kind. Overall, manufacturing provided about a third of all employment in the U.S. economy in the 1950s, a post-war high. Today, it is less than 9% and falling. Despite rising wages and near full employment, prices rose only moderately across the decade, far less than during the 1940s. Stable prices created a sense of predictability, allowing Americans to think ahead about how to spend their extra cash. Home ownership spiked. More Americans owned their own homes in 1960 than in 1950, 53% compared to 48%. The newest appliance in those homes was the television, which was present in 87% of American households by 1960. As the suburbs expanded, Americans bought more cars. In 1950, 59% of families owned a car, but by 1960, 73% did. And most of those cars were made in America by one of three companies, General Motors, Ford, or Chrysler. And, of course, Americans had more babies than ever, creating a significant post-war baby boom. The numbers make it plain. Americans in the 1950s enjoyed a higher standard of living than any previous generation in the nation's history. They earned more money, owned their own homes, drove their own cars, and bought non-essential consumer goods. And contrary to popular belief, not only men benefited. Female participation in the workforce rose during the 1950s from 34 to 38%. Compared to the world they had been born into, a world of economic depression and war, rationing of scarce goods, social and class conflict, and anxiety about the future, American adults by the mid-1950s saw their lives as unusually prosperous, stable, and secure. Simply put, for more families than ever, life in America was good and getting better. 4. Does Eisenhower deserve the credit for this prosperity? Not entirely. America benefited in the 1950s from many positive trends that owed nothing to Ike: a growing population and a better educated one, pent-up demand among consumers after 15 years of hardship, cheap oil and energy, innovations in technology and science, and the creation of a vast market of consumer goods, stimulated by the rapid expansion of the advertising agency. The global picture was also favorable. Germany and Japan, which would challenge American economic dominance after the 1970s, still faced formidable domestic reconstruction problems. And the world economy still ran on dollars, supporting America's ability to export its wares around the world. The country enjoyed a healthy trade surplus throughout the decade. In such circumstances, perhaps any president would look good. Yet Eisenhower's policies did matter. In seeking a balanced budget, developing tax policy, expanding social welfare benefits, and guiding government investment in infrastructure, Eisenhower made significant choices that reflected his philosophy of government. This he described succinctly: a liberal attitude toward the welfare of people and a conservative approach to the use of their money. This language was keenly political and designed to generate a national consensus. Eisenhower knew that Republicans carried the heavy weight of recent failure. The previous Republican administration had been Herbert Hoover's, and on his watch the nation tumbled into a severe depression. Eisenhower called the Hoover experience the skeleton in the Republican closet. Hoover had failed to act vigorously to address the desperate economic conditions the nation faced. Austerity had only worsened the depression, and the lessons of the 1930s indicated that government had to be active and creative. Eisenhower wanted to find the right policies that would allow a proper role for government intervention in the economy, while encouraging individual initiative. As he explained in 1954, government must play a vital role in maintaining economic growth and stability. But I believe that our development, since the early days of the Republic, has been based on the fact that we left a great share of our national income to be used by a provident people with a will to venture. His principal obsession, from which all other policies flowed, was the balanced budget. Pursuit of this goal demanded thrift, sacrifice, and discipline, characteristics he equated with virtuous government. A budget deficit represented weakness, both moral and political, and deficits he believed produced inflation, which he thought of as simple theft, the stealing of the value of hard-earned savings. Eisenhower inherited a $10 billion deficit from Truman and set his two toughest budget slashers, Joseph Dodge and George Humphrey, to work on cutting government spending. They cut $4.5 billion out of Truman's last budget, and then, during the first 2 years of Ike's administration, they slashed still more. They managed to get overall spending down from $74 billion in 1953 to $67 billion in 1954 and $64 billion in 1955. In January 1955, Eisenhower proposed to Congress a balanced budget for fiscal year 1956, July 1955 to June 1956, an astonishing turnaround in the nation's fiscal fortunes. Much of this cutting was made possible by the end of the Korean War, which Eisenhower had helped bring about, and by the consequent cuts in government personnel, both military and civilian. This rapid falloff of government spending, however, tipped the economy into recession in 1954, as economic growth briefly paused and unemployment rose to 5%. No matter. Eisenhower believed a balanced budget would eventually provide conditions for rapid recovery of growth. Always keen to balance the budget, Ike felt little urgency in cutting personal income taxes. Tax rates in the United States, which had been low before 1940, shot up during World War II. Despite some reduction in 1946 and 1948, tax rates went back up during the Korean War and stayed high throughout the 1950s. In the Eisenhower years, marginal tax rates for the lowest brackets floated at between 20 and 26%. Unlike today, working people on the bottom rungs of the economic ladder paid income taxes in addition to Social Security payroll taxes. But the rates were progressive. The moderately well-off paid much more. A head of household who earned $20,000 in 1953, the equivalent of $175,000 today, faced a marginal tax rate of 52%. As for the very wealthy, they were soaked. The top marginal rate was 91% in 1953, though very few Americans made enough money, over $200,000, to qualify for that heavy burden. Conservatives decried these high rates and expected that when a Republican president took office, he would slash them. This is what Ike had promised in the 1952 campaign. But despite intense pressure from his Treasury Secretary George Humphrey, as well as the old guard in his own party, Eisenhower insisted that taxes not be cut until government expenditures had been tamed. The president abjured what later became known as supply-side economics, the theory that tax cuts would work as a stimulant to business and would pay for themselves by generating economic dynamism. No. He insisted that taxes be trimmed only as a reward for cutting spending. He managed to get Congress to agree to extend the Korean War measure, the excess profits tax, for the duration of 1953. This extension was in effect a tax increase and signaled Eisenhower's position that deficits were a greater worry than taxes. In his 1954 budget proposal, he asked Congress to sustain the corporate tax rate, then set at the remarkably high rate of 52%, and to keep in place excise taxes on liquor, tobacco, automobiles, and gasoline. These measures, he said, would help balance the budget and stimulate confidence and economic growth. When in the spring of 1954, Democrats in Congress called for significant tax cuts, Eisenhower took his case to the public. In a television address, he sympathized with his audience. "I know how burdensome your taxes have been," he said. But Americans also wanted certain important improvements like an expansion of Social Security, unemployment insurance, more public housing, better health care, and more schools. These things cost money, and that money would come from taxes. His administration proposed reforms to the tax code that would allow certain classes of lower-income people to get a break, but he opposed across-the-board tax cuts as likely to lead to deficits and inflation. The good American, he suggested, doesn't ask for a favored position or treatment. Naturally, he wants all fellow citizens to pay their fair share of the taxes, just as he has to do, and he wants every cent collected to be spent wisely and economically. But every real American is proud to carry his share of that national burden. In a classic statement of Eisenhower's values, he rejected the idea that some people should get special tax breaks. "I simply do not believe for one second that anyone privileged to live in this country wants someone else to pay his own fair and just share of the cost of his government." Yet the president did agree to a variety of new tax policies in the Internal Revenue Act, a major piece of legislation he signed in August 1954 that shaped tax policy for the next 30 years. Rather than focus simply on cutting marginal tax rates, the administration, Treasury, and congressional staffs worked during 1953 to craft a new tax code that opened up a variety of favorable tax breaks. The new rules allowed for a greater range of deductions and exemptions dealing with dependent children, medical expenses, child care expenses, and the exclusion of various forms of government assistance from taxation. More favorable rules for the taxing of dividend income were also included, and rules that favored small business. Rather than offer across-the-board tax cuts, Eisenhower kept income tax rates high, while giving away a certain amount of revenue through tax loopholes. Ike resented that some critics called his tax proposal a rich man's law. He saw it as a thoughtful combination of targeted tax reduction and economic stimulation. He simply did not want to slash revenues and add to the debt. "Every dollar spent by the government," he wrote to a friend, "must be paid in taxes, now or by our children." Although his party supported the bill in Congress and managed to get it past Democratic objections, the lingering effect of the bill hurt Eisenhower's reputation among his own right wing as a man who was prepared to roll back the New Deal. It also left him open to the charge, effectively made by John Kennedy in 1960, that his administration had done nothing to cut taxes. The impression that Eisenhower had repudiated his campaign tax pledges made conservatives anxious. So too did his warm embrace of the signature New Deal program, the Old Age and Survivors Insurance Program, better known as Social Security. Since 1935, this scheme had allowed workers and their employers to pay into a retirement fund to be paid out in installments after a certain number of years of work. As a candidate, Eisenhower had denounced what he called the creeping socialism of the New Deal, and declared that if Americans wanted security, they could go to jail and have their meals and housing provided for free. But once in office, he adopted a far more generous and indeed progressive outlook on the provision of Social Security benefits for working Americans. Eager to sever any link to the heartless policies of the previous Republican administration, Eisenhower unambiguously embraced the principle of Social Security in his 1953 State of the Union address. "The individual citizen must have safeguards against personal disaster inflicted by forces beyond his control," he insisted. 3 weeks later, he used a homely metaphor to reassure Americans, "It is a proper function of government to help build a sturdy floor over the pit of personal disaster, and to this objective we are all committed." Eisenhower would be no Herbert Hoover. Among his first acts as president in March 1953 was the consolidation of such programs under a newly created Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Billed as an efficiency move, it also elevated the executive in charge of administering Social Security to cabinet rank. Ovita Kalpambi, a Texan who had run the Women's Army Corps during the war, was tapped for the position. She then chaired a commission to recommend ways to extend Social Security to millions of workers who were not yet included. From its inception in 1935, the program had not been available to many self-employed professionals, including architects, dentists, accountants, lawyers, farm owners, farm workers, domestic workers, waiters and waitresses, fishermen and religious ministers. Many government workers and public school teachers were not included either. This gap in coverage hurt the industry.